there's not much to both of these. I was very controlled each other's sight. That means that we have effector molecules that will alter the relationship of the subunits that are found within this enzyme. They're usually subunits, and if they're very tightly connected to each other, then their activity is slowed down. If they are loosely configured, the activity speeds up. Based on your knowledge of enzyme kinetics, and the Michaelis mentioned, in the Michaelis-Menten equation, we're talking about 1 over Km values, and you may recall the 1 over Km values to do with binding affinity. And so we're changing the binding affinity of the enzyme to the substrate, which in turn then regulates its activity. And so we have positive receptor molecules binding and altering the binding affinity. They're generally at the beginning of a pathway or the point of a branch. So if it's the point of a branch, you can go down the other branch because maybe that branch is not yet saturated with the product. If they are both saturated with product, then it will come back and feed back to that point above the branch and so on and so on. So they're not every enzyme in the pathway. They are at the beginning of the pathway and the branch one. And again, they're controlling the activity. That means that the enzymes involved in this particular pathway are constitutively synthesized, meaning they're always on. And so you can think of something like EMT pathway, glucose to pyruvate. It's always on, but we can regulate how fast it works. We don't ever just turn it off, hold our breath, and see if we need any more ATP in the next minute or two. So basically, it gets regulated to work faster or slower, but it's not turned off in terms of the enzyme synthesis. It's always present. Just the activity is regulated. Contrary to that, the off-on level, we often have backup pathways, or pathways that are not necessarily used all the time. They could be used to produce specific amino acids, which may be available in the media. And so if you don't need to make it your own, if it's given to you, then it's no big deal. You can have the system turned off and you can use what's in the media. In the case of carbohydrates, it could be a backup carbohydrate source, such as the example we gave, which was a lactose operon, an alternate way of getting carbon-carbon bonds and breaking them down and getting ATP out of those electrons in the bond. So we have backup systems, alternative things, not something that must be on, but something that may be on if we need it. In which case we have a little lead time, because it takes a little bit of time to take a piece of DNA, transcribe it into messenger. Messenger sits on the ribosome. Protein is then made. Okay? And so that time lag is not something you can afford if it's an essential pathway that you need right now, like the EMT pathway. And so this is going to be a backup system that's important to kick in when you need it. Again, it's controlling the enzyme synthesis. And we have either on or off modes. And we have a constitutive system that's always on, as in the pathway that we described. So constitutive enzyme systems are generally controlled with allosteric control, whereas the backup systems are usually turned off and on with induction. And we have the classic example of that of the lactose operon, which is the first operon of the gene cluster that was identified. Again, the term operon means just that, a gene cluster under a single regulatory role. And these are genes that are all associated with the same pathway. They could be, in the case of like lactose operon, a small amount of lactose gets into the cell by a very inefficient system. But when we need lactose to be brought into the cell, a specific structural gene is encoded for as so-called permease, that is, it's a transport protein that specifically brings in large amounts of lactose. So that's a turned off moment because you don't need that. A little bit of lactose sneaks into the cell and that's okay. But if you actually have to use it as a carbohydrate source, we need to really specifically import this, and so we need to get transport. The other enzymes in there could be enzymes involved with the breakdown of lactose, so-called pentose pathway. So we have the promoter region, where we have the binding of the transcriptase. The operator region, which turns it on or off, it's a red light or a green light. If a repressor protein is so-called sitting on the operator, as you see in the diagram here. In this position, that's a no-go, that's a turn-off, that's a red light. So the structural genes that follow it in the transcription sequence are not transcribed. If the repressor protein does not bind to the operator, then the transcriptase that binds to the motor region will read along and transcribe, make messenger RNAs that will be Y, A, G, and so on, therefore making the protein. Example. First example is that of the Pasteur effect. And we can look at that. If I get this off the center, it's yellow screen or something like that. So we have glucose and we have glucose, as you know, we're going to be breaking it down into a series of enzymatic reactions, and we're going to make pyruvate. For pyruvate, the electrons are going to go down the electron transport system, and we'll have a final electron acceptor converted to a final product. So the acceptor goes to the final product. And that usually accompanies the addition of hydrogen. Okay. So for example, if this was aerobic respiration, then we would have something like oxygen becoming water. If this was anaerobic respiration, we might have sulfur becoming H2S. If this was the fermentation pathway, it's generally a more abbreviated electron transport system, one or two steps. And we have an organic compound as our final electron acceptor and an organic compound as our final product. Carbon-carbon bond left of the organic compound indicates that we have less ATP than the molar glucose. So that's where the electrons go. The carbons of pyruvate will go to the Krebs cycle. And, of course, it's also known as the tricarboxylic acid, or TCA cycle. And that will spin off, among other things, amino acids, so we have amino acids on synthesis. So it's a recycling of those carbons. So if you think of that whole biosphere system, the electrons came from the sunlight, and the carbons were linked together with carbon dioxide, the plant picked up carbon dioxide, and then the plant makes glucose. Now we're breaking down the glucose, freeing up the electrons that originally came from the sun, and we're going to use those to work, because it's going to bring ADP to ATP, which is going to be in the form of a high energy phosphate bond. So this should be just a general overview, but it's intended that we can have all this in detail about chemistry. And so now we want to look at the allosteric control. This is the Pasteur effect. Pasteur saw the blacksmith working, and the blacksmith was pumping in with the billows air into a coal pit to get fire hotter so that they could bend the horseshoes. And so the more air they put pumped in, the hotter it got, the more coal it consumed. So he thought that if he had an organism in a jar and he bubbled in oxygen, it would consume more glucose. The idea that it's an oxidative fire, in a sense. So you add more oxygen, it should burn more glucose. But that's not what happened. Just the opposite happened. When he added more oxygen, the organism used less glucose. And it wasn't even like a statistical, maybe a little bit. It was 12-fold difference. So with oxygen, it used 1/12 as much glucose as it did without oxygen. phosphorglutokinase. Phosphoglutokinase. It's an allosteric enzyme early in the glycolytic scheme. And ATP, as well as citrate, will feed back, and they will be negative effector molecules. Okay. So the end product, in a sense, of Krebs cycle, at least the one component of the Krebs cycle, and the end product of electron transport system, ATP, are really what happens to the electrons and the carbons and glucose, so it's really the end products of the glycolysis. Pyruvate is really an intermediate, it's not an end product. It's a common intermediate, from there we have all kinds of different outcomes. The pyruvate is the intermediate for aerobic respiration, anaerobic respiration, or any of the fermentation. It all goes to pyruvate. Oxygen or not is after that. So glucose to pyruvate is common, so therefore that's not the end product, but the end product in this case is the ATP and citrate. And so they're feeding back to phosphoglutokinase as a negative effector molecule, saying, enough of this, we don't need to break down any more glucose, we have met our needs. Conversely, such things as ADP or AMP can feed back, and that will be a positive effector molecule. Because that means we're not getting enough ATP, and we need to work harder. We need to break more glucose down. So, we had an organism that was an anaerobic organism, let's say this facultative anaerobe. So in this allosteric example with Pasteur effect, we have to have, as he had, a facultative anaerobe, an organism that can undergo aerobic respiration or fermentation. It was fermenting. He added more oxygen. It switched from fermentation to aerobic respiration. It went from an inefficient system to a more efficient system. And therefore, being more efficient, it needed less glucose to meet its energy needs. So unlike the analogy of the coal, when he added oxygen, it didn't use more glucose, it used less. So to make this experiment work, you have to have a facultative anaerobe, and then you add oxygen to it, and it switches from fermentation to respiration. Okay. Everybody got that? So that's Pasteur. Example of operon level control is known as catalyte suppression or dioxy growth curve. Catalyte suppression indicates that one compound is inhibiting the activity of another one or the use of another one. One catalyte is suppressing another catalyte. Dioxy growth means that we have a diphasic growth curve. Not the standard live law of stationary death, but without modification. So we have time around the bottom. We have the law of the number of organisms inside. And we have a lag phase, a log phase, stationary phase, and then we have a little bit of color. Then we have another lag phase, log phase, stationary phase, diphase. In the first part of it, even though we give the organism two carbohydrate sources, glucose and lactose, in the first part it's glucose only. Second part, it's lactose only. So how does it do that in the beginning? beginning, glucose and lactose are both in the media. But the organism clearly shows a preference. That preference is so strong that it goes to lag while it's stationary, and it's ready to go into death phase when finally decides, okay, you got me, I'll have to use lactose. So then you use the lactose system. So how do you do that? Well, as it turns out, the glucose system, of course, is a constitutive enzyme system. It's controlled by allosteric enzymes. It's always on. The lactose system is a inducible system. Now, it takes lactose to induce the lactose operon. But that's necessary but insufficient. It needs something else. So there's glucose and lactose in the system to begin with, but lactose alone is not enough to do it. What you need are high levels of cyclic AMP. And cyclic AMP levels are affected by the utilization of glucose. And so we might have something like this. Cyclic AMP level. So the cyclic AMP level, when it starts utilizing glucose, it drops down. But when it gets to the end of that, that cyclic AMP level rises significantly. So cyclic AMP levels then rise. Cyclic AMP is a necessary co-inducer of the lactose operon. So when glucose is no longer being used, the levels of cyclic AMP levels rise. Lactose plus these higher levels of cyclic AMP induce the lactose operon, and we now have a different system going on. So glucose inhibits utilization of lactose. So glucose only, lactose only, diphasic growth curve. Now what we're seeing is the use of glucose and lactose as carbohydrate sources. The same kind of diphasic growth can be seen with a variety of other things associated with the cell. The availability and use of divalent cations. If you give the organism magnesium and calcium, it prefers magnesium usually, and it uses that whenever possible, but when it can't use it, it will then trigger the utilization of calcium. There's a lot of these pairs. This is just one example of such a pair. Anybody from the UP? And the bridge was plus minus yesterday, the wind and everything. Let's say we all go to visit their house. And of course, they live in the middle of nowhere, and there's actually a doorway on the second or third floor without a porch or anything just there. And when the snow builds up to 15 feet, they can get out of the house. Now, in their refrigerator, they have Dos Equis beer and Meyer brand diet grape pop food. And so you're visiting them, and they're in a snowstorm, so you decide you're thirsty about something. And so you could drink both the beer and the diet pop together. But probably not. What you might do is drink the beer first. And then you don't immediately start drinking but when you get really thirsty and the levels of cyclic AMP levels rise, then you'll convert to drinking the diet. It's the same sort of thing here. We have something that we'd rather do first, and only when we have to, we'll do something second. And there's something that rises up. So in this case, our thirst equates to cyclic AMP levels. And our choices of something to drink are like the choices of carbohydrates. This was metabolite depression. The drinking of the beer inhibited you from drinking the pop. The use of the glucose inhibits you from utilizing lactose if you're an organism. genetics. It was thought, well into the 1920s and so on, that the early 1920s, mid-1920s, that the only way organisms could change their genetic information was through mutation. It was given, that was what it was. Until someone put a pencil to paper or a calculator and so on, and they figured out they had averages of that. But they figured out that this just didn't hold up to scrutiny. They figured that the error of base pairs, that is, making a mutation, the error of base pair situation is about 1 in a million base pairs. And if you're dealing with double-stranded DNA, that's generally repaired by the repair enzyme. And so for the likelihood of that actually being maintained is smaller than 1 out of a million. Then you can consider that those things that are maintained, most of those mutations in a bacterial cell are lethal mutations. If you suddenly don't make phosphofructokinase, you're in a world of hurt because you can't make sufficient levels of ATP and you die. If you suddenly can't make a membrane, you die. If you suddenly can't make cell walls, unless you're microplasma, which you couldn't make in the first place, but if this organism that had a cell wall can't make it, it dies. So there's an awful lot of essential information in the genome. There's not a lot of fluff. So there's not like, you know, eye color and hair color and variations like that, which you can have changes in which aren't lethal. Most changes in microbial organisms are lethal changes. A relatively rare event that occurs. Most often it's repaired, so therefore it doesn't continue. And if it does continue, it's probably lethal. All of those argue against the idea that this organism uniquely changes its genetic information. So that didn't seem to add up. So there must be some other mechanism. And as it turns out, we find out that there are mechanisms of genetic exchange. So we're picking up external information and inserting it into the genome, rather than simply a mutation. Now, mutations do occur, but they're on the rarer side. The fact that they occur rarely but then are communicated is a significant part, the exchanging. Now, the information that we're talking about includes a wide variety of characteristics of microorganisms, the ability to grow a certain media, for example, use production of a certain exoenzyme so they can import something unusual, break down something unusual in the environment. But it also means that it's producing a virulence factor, maybe an exoenzyme or an exotoxin. Or more even relevant than that, the ability to exchange genetic information relative to antimicrobial resistance. And so a characteristic is picked up, and if it's a virulence factor, it can completely change the pathology associated with a given organism. We sometimes refer to these as emerging pathogens. But we don't want to give the impression that these emerging pathogens are extremely rare and never seen before. But these emerging pathogens are a constant problem. An organism that doesn't cause much in the way of disease suddenly starts killing people. That's significant. Particularly if you're the first group of people to die because the diagnosis is often missed. Oh, it can't be that guy. He's Fred Friendly. He doesn't cause any problems. And all of a sudden you realize Fred Friendly is really an evil genius fellow who's got this new toxin. Okay. So the Muppets, you've probably seen Muppets on television, and then there were little Muppets. The guy who invented the Muppets and had the Muppets on television died of just that kind of thing. An organism that was not a bad guy killed him. So we have these emerging pathogens, and they pick up new variances and spread them around. But they don't seem to spread as rapidly as antimicrobial resistance. Because we help the process of antimicrobial resistance. Because when we use an antibiotic, we select for the resistant organism. Really important idea. Really easily misunderstood, misinterpreted, misapplied. We select for the resistant organism. Use of the antibiotic does not cause the organism to pick up new information It does not cause a change in the genome that creates a new information. It merely selects for the resistant one. And since where it is, we can replicate fairly rapidly and come about in very high numbers. A small incidence, one out of a million bug, one out of 10 to the 6th, but you kill off all but that one bug because you use the antibiotic. Now the one bug is the only one resistant, it's the only one surviving, and now you have the rest of them growing from that. They're all descendants of the resistant one. So now you have all the descendants are resistant. You went from one out of a million to a million out of a million in a matter of two generations of organisms. So the more we use an antibiotic, the more we can't use it in the future. We select for the resistant one. A major, major, major problem. Can't state, overstate it too much. So this problem, we need to understand how it is that the organisms spread it around themselves. They can't seem to stop that rare, extremely rare change. But if we can keep it where it is, then it's not a big problem. If it spreads, it's a big problem. And they do spread. So, mechanisms of exchange. Exchanging of any genetic information. The ability to grow in certain media. The ability to produce a virulence factor. And the ability to be antimicrobial resistant. Well, in 1928 or thereabouts, a fellow by the name of Griffin, working in the UK, in London, whose biochemistry book was not as thick as yours, he did not know as much as you know, began to work on a problem. Now, transformation, in the thumbnail definition, is the picking up, the incorporation of cell-free DNA. So the first cell dies, it's the donor. Its genetic information is broken up into 100 pieces, and a second cell can scavenge, pick up that free cell-free DNA, and incorporate it into its genome by substitution, a swap. So, transformation, in a phrase, cell-free DNA. Transduction is when a bacterial virus enters a host cell and steals some bacterial information. And when it leaves, it puts in its nucleocapsid suitcase bacterial genes. And when it invades the next host, it brings into the second bacterial host genetic information from the first. So transduction is bacteriophage stealing. Conjugation, this is sex in bacteria. Direct contact between bacterial cells with the structure that we referred to before as a sex villi. We thought of maybe this sex villi structure as sort of a pretzel stick, but in fact it's more like a straw. Because once we've made contact with the second bacterial cell, a hollow tube, a conjugation tube, which allows genetic information and cytoplasmic information, cytoplasm flows back and forth between the cells. So we have sex in bacteria. It's a little different than ours. There are one type of female cell or recipient cell and three types of male or donor cells. Transformation requires the death of the donor. Transduction requires death of the donor. But in conjugation, there's life after sex. So that's about the death of the donor. So let's go into these in a little more detail. There's some drawings or things like that. First picture is, again, transformation, cell-free DNA. In order for a cell to pick up the foreign DNA, it has to have a membrane transport protein, and that's called the competence factor. Now, competence factor is produced in late log and early stationary phase. It is part of the activation of genomic information is sometimes referred to as secondary metabolites. This is sort of extra information. Now that we have time, we can do this. We've got the cell growing really, really well. We're in log phase. And let's see what else we can find and produce. And so the cell actually begins to produce products from its own genome that it did not have before, did not produce. So-called secondary metabolites. And in this example, competence factor, a membrane protein that allows it to pick up foreign DNA, is produced at that point. If you try to do the experiment in which the recipient cell is in lag phase, nothing happens. It doesn't have the competence factor. In early log, it doesn't have the competence factor. But in late log, or stationary, it can pick up foreign DNA. Now, there are other important characteristics associated with these so-called secondary metabolites produced in late log and early stationary. Organisms produce compounds that inhibit their neighbors, especially when the food starts getting short, the nutrients get short. That's when it's really important to get rid of the people that you don't like. So when you're just starting out in the lag phase and early log phase and things are going really well, you don't mind a little competitor someplace along the way. But when things get going a little too tight and the nutrient sources get a little bit scarce, late log or stationary, that's when the bacterial cells or the fungal organisms will produce compounds that inhibit the growth of surrounding organisms. Now, we've taken many of these compounds, not all of them, but many of them, we call them antibiotics. We've discovered them. Now, you know, the bugs have been using them for generations and millions of years, but we label them that we discovered them. So we've discovered these antibiotics. They are also secondary metabolites. So if you were in the business of making antimicrobial agents in the lab, you're going to be growing the organisms and producing these secondary metabolites. The secondary metabolites, we can play games with this lag, log, stationary death curve. Remember, it's dependent upon the availability of nutrients and the building up of pH and so on, which will convert that from a very rapid growth to a stationary phase. So if we have this growing in a large tank, and we buffer the solution so the acid condition doesn't develop right away, and we keep pumping in nutrients, we can keep that organism real slow on that growth curve. And we can expand that point of late log or early stationary. So instead of just being a transient point where it goes through, maybe something that would last for 90 minutes normally, we can have it work for maybe 9 or 10 days by adjusting the environment that the organism is in. To do that, we have to have sensing devices to know what the pH is and what the availability of oxygen is and all the other things. And that structure is called a hemostat. So if you work for a drug company that is making antimicrobial agents, they have these large incubators, fermenters, that are hemostats that we can regulate the concentration of various components of the media, and we can extend that little period of time, late log, early stationary, for a long period of time. And we can then harvest lots of that secondary metabolite. Once it gets well into the stationary phase, we don't worry about it anymore, we put a little blood in the system, we start all over again. And we have to start then the lag phase to an early log, and then late log, early stationary, we can expand that again. So we can play games with the organism and modify that growth curve. So we have competence factor, membrane protein, in a category of the so-called secondary metabolites, which are produced when the cell is going well and it activates other aspects of the genome. But there are many of these secondary metabolites. Competence factor is just one of many. Well, here's the summary of Griffin's experiment in 1928. It's sort of an interesting thought process that we worked through. He took Streptococcus pneumoniae, and he found a mutant of it that lacked the capsule. Now, when he grew the Streptococcus pneumoniae, and he can do this today, it's nothing unusual, on a cell culture, on an artificial media, on a culture, when you're growing it on artificial media, the organism produces a wet-looking colony. It's that all the organisms descending from a single cell that are piled up on top of each other, creating a colony. And that has colonial morphologies, that is, it has structures and colors and sizes that are indicative of that organism. And that colonial morphology gives a wet look because of all the gooey capsules. You remember the capsule is this ones. He called them the smooth ones. Also the smooth, wet, and smooth. And then the dry ones, he called them rough. So we have the normal organism with a capsule is the smooth variety. And the mutant that couldn't produce the capsule was the rough variety. So, the fact he starts his experiment. He takes the living smooth, which is virulent, has the ability to kill the organism, and he puts it, I can't quite see it, is it supposed to have a little capsule around it, a little halo around it here? So this one's got a halo around it, and it kills the mouse. Mice are extremely susceptible to streptococcus pneumonia. They'll die in 12 hours or less. So you can inoculate them probably by night, and from the next morning they're okay. So that worked. That is, it killed the mouse. And you could get the living smooth, the organisms from the lung through the mouse. He took the rough variety, the non-virulent, doesn't have a capsule, but it's still alive. He injects that into the mouse, and the mouse is still looking at him in the cage the next morning. And he probably can't isolate too much, but if he could, it would be the rough variety, because it's going to be really fragile cover, so it's not going to be too much there. But the mouse is going to be alive. So that everything is as we thought. Then he takes the smooth variety again, and he heat kills it. He just boils it in the intestine. So now it's dead, but it did have a capsule. So he takes this dead organism with a capsule, injects it in the mouse, and it lives too. And the dead organisms don't cause death of the organism, the mouse. But then he did something really strange. The living rock that doesn't kill and the heat kills food are mixed together. And when he mixes them together, the next morning, the mouse is dead. Two things that by themselves did not kill, put it together, and they killed. And what's more, he was able to get smooth, living smooth, out of the dead mouse. Now he got a little bit of the rough stuff, not too many, but he got a lot of the living smooth. Where did it come from? Did he not boil it enough? Well, his control diet was fine. And it was a control that only got this, and the control that only got that, while it was still alive. And so it probably wasn't something like that. So what was it? Well, we went into his chemistry book. Remember the shorter one, not as long as the one you had. And he said, well, maybe it's a protein. So we removed all the protein from this heat kill mixture, and it's still mixed with the living drops, and it still killed the mouse. Then he removed all the sugars, the carbohydrates. Same thing, mouse died. And he removed all the lipids. That was the end of the book, the lipids. And still the mouse died. So whatever was in here, something he called the transforming principle, that transforming principle, whatever it was, that converted the living rock into a living smooth, that something was not a protein, was not a carbohydrate, was not a lipid. Now, if you could be transported back in time and go to the, meet him on high tea and have a pump or something like that, you could whisper the answer to him. Okay? Or currently, you could go to Cambridge and Berry and talk to him and tell him what he missed. Because what did he not know? Yes, but what's the transmission? But what biochemical feature was in here that he didn't destroy? DNA. Okay. He didn't have a chapter on nucleotides. He didn't know about DNA. It wasn't discovered yet. No one knew about it. Okay. So the DNA is what this living rock is able to pick up. Look at it something like this. Here we have the living rock with this capital letter genome here. And here we have the, and that's the recipient cell. The donor cell has died. And we have bits and pieces of the donor cell DNA scattered around the medium. And the cell can incorporate about 1% of the genome, and so these bits and pieces are about each, about 1%. And it randomly picks up these pieces, and you see in this last case, we have made a substitution. Notice the genome doesn't get bigger, but we have a little A and a little B. So the little A and little B is inside. transforms this cell. So now that it has new genetic information. This is not some sort of thought process. This is not some sort of, I need something, so where can I go shopping and get it? This is a random event. So when we have the cells surrounded by different pieces of the genomic information from this smooth organism, which was in our heat shield preparation, the recipient cell picks up 100 different pieces of blood. 100 different recipient cells each pick up one piece of 1%. 99 out of those do not pick up the information they capsule, so they're not part of the story. Only one of them, 1%, pick up this information. So it's not like I need this and now I've got to get it. It's just a swap. Anybody here from like Tampa or someplace? Anybody from South Carolina, California, New Mexico, Arizona? Everybody here has experienced winter. So then what you know then is that occasionally when your car is in the lot and you have a Sears diehard battery, somebody pushes their car next to your lot and they have an old interstate battery that doesn't work anymore. And they open up the both hoods and they swap the battery. People think they're helping you out or something, but no, they're stealing your battery. Okay. And so then they drive away with your good diehard battery. But of course, if your car is in the lot because you too have a dead battery, and they push their dead battery car up to yours and swap the batteries, another dead battery and then pushing it to somebody else's car. But this is not a thought process, we're just swapping pieces. And that's exactly what's happening here. We're just swapping out. We're not making two batteries in a car, we're not making larger genomic information. We're just substitution. Just a substitution. And here's another, there's several other cartoons I'll let you play, but we don't need to go through the details. Here we have the donor and the recipient. We have cells in the DNA. Remember, this is the only one that has the confidence factor that we'll talk about. And you can see that we have different pieces of information coming in. Not to worry about it. And it's more like a pool table or something. Basically the same, this is the information. Okay, so those are all different ways of working on it. But basically understand this information that we have cell-free DNA being picked up. Now this is a very inefficient system, because you have to pick up that information right away, because quickly it will be denatured in the environment. So it's not a very efficient system. It is interesting to note that you don't have to do the same genome. That is, it doesn't have to be the same genus and species. So bacteria can pick up from genetic information from a wide variety of other species. Not 100%, there are some little nuances, but basically it's not E. coli with E. coli. So there's lots of opportunity out there, but you have to get it fresh. You have to get it quickly after it's been released, because shortly after it's released, in another minute, it starts to be denatured. It's sort of fragile, there's cell around it. And so it's not a very efficient system, but it can be done. Transduction. Bacteriophage screening. Oh, somebody made a request for us to take a 2-minute break about now. So why don't we do a 2-minute break or so? Right about now. Right about now. Yes, didn't they?
Yeah. New England doesn't look that good this year.
I think the Jets are, or Baltimore's tough this year.
I bet Baltimore. New England just looks like that. Shape. And Brady hasn't looked that good this year.
And they're deep. We need to have some more terms under our belt. Knowledge base. So we have a bacterial virus invading bacterial cell, you already have an understanding that this causes a lytic infection and makes more of the virus and it blows it apart and so on. That's a lytic infection released by perspiration. But another thing is also possible, and that is a lysogenic infection. A lysogenic infection is when the virus inserts into the genome, but it sort of remains hidden for a while. So we have bacterial cell, and we have the virus, and we have the bacterial genome. Bacterial DNA. This is bacteriophage DNA. And what happens is we have an invasion.
Messenger RNA, it sits on those cell ribosomes and it makes
messenger RNA makes the protein. But the protein is the viral protein that is secreted by the organism that causes the bacterial intoxication that we call diphtheria. That particular toxin, diphtheria toxin, interferes with protein synthesis in eukaryotic cells. In biochemistry, we learned of elongation factors 1 and 2, and that's it interferes with elongation factor number 2. So the making of the protein on the ribosome is interfered with. Elongation factor number 2 is the target of that. And we have the shutting down protein synthesis in your cells caused by a bacterial infection that is in turn a result of a viral infection of the bacteria. So it's not invaded by bigger fight, it doesn't do anything. Now this relationship can be further defined by the outcomes of lysogeny. So let's take a look at some outcomes of lysogeny. So we'll draw a little like a dimming state again. Specialized transductions, yes. always stealing the same thing. So in specialized transduction, we get pure corn or pure peas or whatever. We know what's coming out, and in fact, we can start doing some manipulation. This was first observed in the mid-1960s, by the early 70s, researchers began to experiment with this idea. In fact, a group of fellows by the name of Beckwith et al., in about 1970, I think, was at a meeting in Boston, and they put up one slide for their award-winning presentation. They had isolated the lactose operon. So using a series of bacteriophages, one would invade the cell, the next one would invade the invaded cell, and it would steal a subset of the first one. So let's say we had three genes transferred the first time. And while it's in the lysogenic state, we invade it by another virus that steals two of those genes. And it goes to another cell. And then we have another third virus that actually stole just one. Complicated series, like the first time took a while to do. Basically, they can have this loaded up with just the lactose operon. And they developed then the technique that you could load up any particular gene in the nucleocapsid of a virus. And of course, that meant that you could then take off the shelf any gene you wanted and add it to any other bacteria. And you could play model with that. You could recombine this and you could make whatever you want. Genetic engineering, which was alluded to by the Germans in World War II, was now a reality in terms of the microorganisms. And what Beckwith et al. Said to the microbiologists, about 10,000 of us in the room, big room, they said that we're not going to tell you how we did it. We all have learned. We're not going to tell you how, because you all are not ready for it. You're not ready to learn how to play around with the genes. And we're all giving up research positions. We're not going to pursue this research any further. Because you're not ready for it. So that movie, You Can't Handle It, that kind of thing. And so people were really upset because they just got awards and all that sort of stuff. And they stomped out of the meeting and people were yelling and screaming. Pandemonium kind of thing. But basically, once you know something can be done, it's a whole lot easier to do it. If it's never been done and you don't know if it ever can be done, that's a little harder to do. So once we knew generally how they did it, it only took us about 5 years and someone else figured out how they did it. So they just delayed things about 5 years. Now we're in the mid-70s, the early 80s, and a fellow is working with these viruses, and he's actually a graduate of my undergraduate school. And he's out in California doing a postdoc. And he's playing around with these enzymes, playing around with the viruses, and he realizes that what happens is that these viruses have the ability to steal because they insert into the genome, and they can insert into the genome because the viruses have endonucleases. They have enzymes that will break open the genome, and they do it in an interesting manner because they create what's called sticky ends. Show you what a sticky end is. So these endonucleases will take a piece of genetic information, double-stranded, cut it on an angle, and it cuts it at particular nucleotide sequences, and wherever that nucleotide sequence is, it will then create a piece. And we generally have about three nucleotides dangling at each end. And that endonuclease is associated with a particular virus. And so you realize there are multiple viruses. Each one has the ability to crack open the DNA at a different point. It's just like when you talk about proteases, that trypsin, chymotrypsin, and so on, always cleave at specific amino acid sequences. These endonucleases also cleave at specific nucleotide sequences. And so you can take, as has been done, a human genome for, let's say, insulin, brings the end. Think a small piece of bacterial genetic information called a plasmid, and also cut it with the same enzyme. So you open it up and it's the same CDNs. And you end up with something that looks like this. This plasmid is a small piece, circular piece of DNA that we can open up with the same endonuclease as we open up the human genome. Now we transfer the human gene for insulin into a small chromosomal element, not really another chromosome, but it's a certain extra genetic information, this plasmid. And now when it's in this other cell, we can stick it into fungal organisms, we can stick yeast organisms, we can stick it into bacterial organisms. And the transcriptases from the host cell will transcribe this. And now we're producing human insulin in a microorganism. Now, to do this effectively, it's not quite as easy as I described, because you do have to have all that operon level stuff, all the control pieces have to be in there. And so we create these little constructs of plasmid, sort of your basic plasmid. It's got an operon and a regulator and all that sort of stuff. And it's also got the enzymes, transport proteins that are associated with transporting the product out. Sort of make the basic model, and then we insert the structural gene, let's say insulin, into that mixture at a specific location. So when it goes into the host cell, it's going to be regulated, it's going to be turned on, and it's going to be producing the transcriptases, the permeases, the transport proteins to get out. And so you have this cell that's secreting it. The first time we did it, we had it stuck inside, and we had to break open the cell all the time to get the product out. But we don't do that anymore. We basically have it secreted. So now we have a little factory that we can feed typically soy auger to. It makes the human genome products. Okay. And we can do this with any low molecular weight compound. So we can do it with insulin can be done. We can do it with interferon, which we'll learn about in the immune system. Human growth hormone, lots of stuff. The only place we have problems are post-transcriptional changes. That is, there are some molecules that after they're made, they're modified. And we have trouble with that. It's only a little hurdle. We'll get over that too. So we'll make the product and we'll modify it and then we'll have that product. So what began with a discussion of bacterial viruses moved into how do they do it, finding that they do it with endonucleases, isolating the endonuclease. We don't need the bacteria anymore. Now, we've nicknamed these endonucleases by the name of the virus we stole them. They've got these funny names like ECHO-R1 and all that kind of stuff. But these are just the names of the virus that from which we got that particular endonuclease. We can do this with a piece of DNA from an unknown person and match it to a known person. We simply take the DNA and cleaving it with specific endonucleases. If the part that it recognizes, that nucleotide sequence, is a really rare part of that particular genome, for that person, then the pieces will really be long. Okay. Whereas if it's a really common piece, it's going to chew it up into small pieces. Okay. We call that restriction length polymorphism, because these enzymes are sometimes called restriction enzymes. So restriction length polymorphism means that the length of the pieces depend upon how common the sequence is attacked by that particular enzyme. And so we can find out whether this matches you or not. We're not reading the whole genome, though it's called DNA fingerprinting. But it's the same, it's really a simple idea. If it's a common sequence, then you break it up in small pieces. If it's not so common, you have bigger pieces. And of course, you can use more than one enzyme and do little fancy things like that, but basically that's the idea. So it began with simply discussing of the viral information. It has now moved into a whole new realm of recombinant DNA technology. Now let's sort of take a look at some of these bits and pieces. Yes?
Going back to the genetic engineering, right. If it could possibly steal all of the host DNA,
by the side of the nucleocapsid.
Okay. Well, I mean, could it have just a DNA section in it and no viral DNA in it at all?
Then it wouldn't be a replicating virus. You wouldn't know how to make it. So let's take a look at the little slide that we have here. Some of these are better than others. Different ones strike the fancy. If you understood what I put down already, you got it all. Okay, so there's nothing new. All right, here we have a bacterial virus that's invading a bacterial cell and injecting the genetic information there on the bottom right. What kind of bacterial cell is this? Gram-negative. You see we have the little polysaccharide there. Okay. And at the transduction, we have the virus inserting the information, so we can see what we're talking about. Transduction, simple isogeny versus transduction. So, simple isogeny, cyanobacterium was a theory example. And transduction was a stealing, which there were two kinds. Let me write down the following little tongue twister. Write down this statement. Somebody tell me what two words clarify what I just said. All transducing bacteriophages, are lysogenic. All transducing bacteriophages are lysogenic. But not all lysogenic bacteriophages are transducing. But not all lysogenic bacteriophages are transducing. Sort of a tongue-twisting kind of mind bender, but what two words describe that? What if we put the word stealing and the word hidden where we see the words lysogeny and transduction? Now we have all stealing viruses are hidden, but not all hidden viruses steal. What two words describe that event that I'm just describing? Give you a hint. It's on the right-hand board. What two-word phrase on the right-hand board describes? Yes, simple lysogeny, okay? Just because you're hidden doesn't mean you're going to steal. But being hidden is essential for stealing to occur. It has to be integrated into the genome for it to steal something. Yes?
So the simple lysogeny, they still go into the host cell and implant their own DNA, they just don't take anything.
They go on the way out. So remember that earlier drawing, a little scribbling there. This is an important one. You should understand this crude drawing here. Better than anything in the textbook. Simple isogeny, what went in, what came out. What comes out, goes in. In generalized transduction, it's a packaging error, and we have bits and pieces. In transduction, we have stealing. There are even, not to confuse the issue with any, but there are even examples of some generalizing which doesn't seem to integrate very much at all. It still steals a little bit. We won't go into that rare possibility. So basically, generalized transduction, specialized transduction, and simple lysogeny are three basic mechanisms. These are the outcomes of lysogeny. So what happens if you get inserted? Steals, doesn't steal, it always steals the same thing, it doesn't steal. And you can take a look at this ceiling, and you can call a little red thing there, and you can call it a blue. You can see that in this case, they're looking at black beside 18 and all that sort of stuff. And here they're talking about then transduction. You can call it a little red gene, which is being still rolling. This was lysogeny, simple lysogeny, knows what went in came out. And then this is ceiling. This one is showing you a transduction. Just call a little red. This is an overview. We've got, again, we have the virus integrates into the genome. We have lysogenic. Remember, we could have a lineage event. Right? when we compare lysogenic and lytic in a way. So the lytic event is just reproduced with our environment. If it goes into a lysogenic stage, the kid divides for months or weeks, and then something triggers it, production, and it goes into a lytic pathway. And this particular node, what we're seeing in the lytic pathway, is simple lysogeny. What went in, a little darker thing, is the only thing coming out. This is the same as this. The one up here and one underneath are the same, so this would be an example of simple lysogeny. And here we have the transduction. So this is the same boost cell. You can call all these little cartoons or not, and you get it. They might draw them better, but these ones in many textbooks. And transduction is play, recombinant DNA technology. Combining the DNA, we didn't care what species we were in, humans and prokaryotes, eukaryotes, fungal organisms, we did it all around. Gene splicing, that was the sticky end. Very important idea, because that allows us to insert it into a plasmid. Of course, the use of the DNA nuclease also allows us to do restriction link polymorphism. All the basis of technology. That fellow that graduated from the St. Sulpice started a company called Genentech. And in the first day of sales, it sold more than anyone else had in prior first day offering. And he was a multi-millionaire, like over $100 million, personal wealth in day one. Not a bad way to start. He spent school with the company and donated hundreds of millions of dollars back to the undergraduate schools. All that good stuff. Retired living on an island. Okay. Conjugation. Sex and bacteria. Direct contact between bacterial cells with a sex pill-off. And here we see an example of something going on here. This is not a very good model, but it's a model. Here we have the plasmid, that's a little circle right here, the plasmid. And a copy of the plasmid, so this is not spilling over this structure from here to here. This is making a copy. A copy is sent over to the second one. So we're sending over a copy. And this is supposed to be merging here. This is sort of an exaggerated view of sex co-op. And we're transferring a copy of the plasmid. Notice that we're sending a copy. So our first thing we have to look at are what plasmids are. We refer to them already. They're fun tools with the biotechnology people to play with. Well, it turns out there are two kinds of plasmids. Okay. Plasmid one is a self-replicating plasmid. And then we have a non-self-replicating plasmid. Okay. The self-replicating plasmid, so both of these extra genomic DNA, so it's in addition to the main chromosome. In the self-replicating, it has genes in it that the non-self-replicating doesn't. For example, it has a gene for transcriptase activity. That means it can copy itself. So it has a transcriptase that allows it to copy itself. So that in this process of conjugation, a copy of the self-replicating self-replicating plasmid will be sent over to the recipient cell. Now, just so we understand how it works, when the cell divides, the cell's bacterial cell's transcriptase will copy the main chromosome and the plasmid. So when it divides, the daughter cells will have the plasmid and the self-replicating plasmid. genome. Okay. So both of these plasmids will be copied when the main chromosome is being copied. But the one on the left, the self-replicating, can do this independent of when the main chromosome is being copied. In addition, the self-replicating plasmid has genetic information to make sex filaments. So the cell that has the self-replicating plasmid will have a sex pili on its surface and will be referred to as being a male cell. If the cell has a non-self-replicating plasmid, it does not have the ability to make sex pili and will not confer maleness, as it's referred to, will not confer maleness to the cell that contains it. Likewise, the non-self-replicating plasmid can only be copied when the main chromosome is being copied. So we have two kinds of plasmids. We can put genetic information on them with recombinant DNA technology, or just as they may be found in nature, can have a wide variety of extra information added to them. So this is not blank landscape here, but a line has got something. So it has a variety of other genes on it. And these may be genes for antimicrobial resistance, or the ability to produce a toxin, or whatever. So these would be genes for toxin production. Antimicrobial resistance, etc. They all have that, but the non-self-replicating has a problem getting around, or at least it's not as easily spread. So we have two kinds of plasmids, self-replicating, non-self-replicating. If we look at this little bowl of Cheerios here, this is the plasmid. These are not on the scale because this is really, really small compared to this. Now, a couple of things about this plasmid. It can grow. We can add more genes to it easily. In fact, the bigger it is, the more stable it becomes. Which is good news for the plasmid, it's not good news for us. So we can add genes to it. Maybe one time it only has a gene to make a toxin. And then we add a gene to it naturally through a process we'll describe. We may add, well, it could be something you already know. It could be transduction. So a virus lands on this sucker and gives it information. And now it has a new character. Now the number of these is also a variable. You may have, let's say, penicillinase, a beta-lactamase that breaks down penicillin, is produced on a plasmid. As it turns out, it's generally a non-self-replicating plasmid, but it's on a plasmid. This little factory for resistance can only produce so much product per unit of time. But what if we had 10 of them? Now you can produce 10 times as much penicillinase per unit of time. Or if you had 100 of them, you can produce 100 times more penicillinase. So, for example, just using penicillin as an example, we have what we call international units. And we started off by using just a few thousand international units for the typical dose of penicillin. And now we use millions of international units. Because if we only use a few thousands or a few hundred thousands, the organism has sufficient level of penicillinase to knock it off. So it may take only the same minimal amount of penicillin to do the job, but the organism has a lot of penicillinase, so you have to add enough to neutralize all that penicillinase so that you get that little bit there to do the job. So the amount of product depends upon how many factors you have or how many plasmids. And the numbers of the plasmids can grow and increase over time. So the size of the plasmid can change, new genetic information, and the number of plasmids can change, resulting in the amount of production of whatever it is we're producing. So mating type. We have three types of male cells, the donor cell, and one type of female cell. Okay. Let's take a look at our cells. So we have the first mating is an F plus cell mated with an F minus cell. And so we have an F plus cell, something like this, F minus cell, so. We have the bacterial genome, and the bacterial genome. That's the genetic information. And then we have a self-replicating plasmid, and it's going to the cytoplasm. This is our plus cell. The sexually makes contact, enzymatically opens up by the end of the straw. We now have the cytoplasm streaming back and forth. A copy of this one is made. A copy of this one is made in a linear form, a linear copy. It goes through that nice and easy fit right in the straw. Gets on the other side, and we have this cell. So now the F minus cell has been converted to an F plus cell. And it can then produce sex cell. So therefore, the mating between an F plus cell and F minus cell gives us two F plus cells because the original one didn't die. So our first example is the donor cell didn't die. The donor cell died in the previous transformation and transduction. And what we spread is maleness. That is, the ability to produce a sex villi and the ability to copy itself, which is a self-replicating plasmid. And I said earlier that the size of the self of the plasmid, whether it's self-replicating or non-self-replicating, the size of the plasmid has an impact on its stability. This is a very small plasmid. It only contains two different genes, transcriptase and pili. And as a result, it's a very fragile kind of thing. And as it tumbles through the cytoplasm, the shear forces of this tumbling result in its destruction. So after a few months, bear in mind that the cell, the plus cell is dividing, becoming two F plus cells and dividing and becoming two more. So this process is expanding greatly in terms of number of cells. But after a couple of months, they will lose that self-replicating plasmid. And for a short period of time, will be sort of phenotypically male, but really not. We won't go into the phenotype of these things. Maybe they'll still have sex pili. They'll sort of fall off. But it no longer knows how they're made. So it'll sort of dilute out. And it took a couple of generations, which would be less than a day, they're rarely seen. So it's building out the population. So for our intents and purposes, it becomes a female cell again. So the natural state is that of a female cell, and what we're seeing is almost like an infection. We have this extra genetic information that was invading the cell, gave it some new characteristics. And now, as it tumbles and tosses and turns, the shear forces just break it. Now, if we want to accelerate this process, we can add a dye known as acridine orange. And acridine orange binds to the DNA. If you think of the shear forces, are sort of like the twisting action on a bracelet. And if you have a small bracelet and you twist it 55 times, it's going to break. Okay. If you had a belly bracelet. You know what I'm talking about? Jewelry around your belly. A belly chain. Something like that. So if you have a bigger belly chain, okay, and you twist it and twist it 55 times, nothing would happen to it. It's so big, and you have to keep twisting and twisting. Okay. But a small one, you can twist it 55 times. What if you had a charm bracelet? A small one that you put little charms on it. And as you twist it, the charms got popped, and they would break it even sooner. It's exactly what's happening with acne orange. It's binding to the DNA like charms in a charm bracelet, and it's getting caught. So therefore, you can break up that cell of getting plasmid in an F-plus cell, a male cell, in minutes. You don't have to wait for months and divide and all that. You can do it right then. Bam. We have sort of an awkward, painful name for that. We call it curing maleness. So we can cure maleness and convert the F-plus cell to a F-minus cell with acridine orange. Take a look at our next data. This is like a block few variations on a theme. This is going to be an HFR cell mated with an F minus cell. This is our HFR cell. The male cell. We have an integrated self-replicating plasmid. An integrated self-replicating plasmid. It's still extra genomic, but now it's attached to chromosome. So here's our A gene and our B gene and our C gene and our D gene and so on. So once this mating occurs, copy itself, but it doesn't do it if it's one end or another, it does it towards the middle. So the next piece we see is the main chromosome. So we say the A gene and the B gene are copies. So we have chromosome A gene, copy, tailing end, part of this self-replicating plasmid. The B gene is copied. And what happens is that it never quite gets in the normal circumstances all the way around. So what we see then in the recipient cell is A and B and maybe C. We have the leading edge there. And we'll give it for reference purposes for a little A, little B, little C. And what will happen then after the wave is back on? The wave. What will happen then is that this cell becomes an F minus cell with new characteristics. So it looks picked up the A gene and the B gene and but it picked up some of the genes from the preceding HFR cell. It's no longer, it's not a male cell, so it can't, doesn't have sex villi. It can't spread this information, but it picked up some new information. So it identified a cell with new genes. So we start with an HFR cell, but we had it integrated into the genome. We sent over part of the information. Reason we probably only send over part of it, because that sex villi is not stable matching. It would have to last together for quite a long time. We can do this in the lab by having them mate in auger. Pour hot auger around and then the auger gels, so now they can't separate, and we can then get the whole chromosome on the problem. But under normal circumstances, the kid comes to the door and waiting stops.